Okay, let's move on to the Jensen case. This is Jensen versus People of the State of Colorado, 2013, SC-211. Ms. Rosenberg, when you're ready, if you please enter your appearance and go ahead then. You have 15 minutes, if you could keep track of your time. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, 17497, counsel for Eric Jensen. If it may please this honorable court this morning. Everybody's in agreement that Mr. Jensen's sentence, which was the mandatorily minimum imposed sentence of life without parole, for an F1 felony, since he was a juvenile and he was given no individualized sentencing, is unconstitutional after Miller. The people have also conceded, at least for purposes of this case, that Miller applies retroactively. So the issue before this court is, where do we go from here? How do we craft a solution? How do we give Mr. Jensen a constitutional sentence? And also, kind of the subset or the corollary question is, how is this going to affect the other 50 juveniles in the same situation? What the Attorney General recommends this court do is simply give everybody a uniform life with parole after 40 is unconstitutional for two reasons. Well, it's untenable for two reasons. The first reason is there's no statutory support for that. What the Attorney General wants this court to do is imposed in the judicial activism that she also told the court that it could not do. In order to get to that sentence for juveniles such as Mr. Jensen, this court would have to completely rewrite the sentencing statutes. You can't get there to life with parole after 40 by just applying the doctrines of revival and severance, because you have to revive the entire 1985 statute. In order for that to work, you're also going to end up with all the adult offenders in that same time period. Their sentences will also have to be life with parole after 40. In order to get to the result of the Attorney General laws, which is to only revive the enforcement of that statute and have it only apply to juveniles, you have to cut and paste, you have to sever portions of that statute, revive only portions of that statute, and then go to portions of later enacted statutes and do this cut and paste job that is impermissible judicial activism. Therefore, the Attorney General's solution does not work. There is no statutory support for that, and I believe at pages 19 through 22, Ms. Lord's brief, she goes in pretty exhaustive detail by walking through the statutes why that is impermissible. So,
Charles, I take it that you adopt Ms. Lord's position as the proper remedy instead of Mr. Samler's. Am I understanding that from what your references to her brief?
Yes. The solution I'm suggesting to this court is the same as Ms. Lord's, that the statutory solution here is you have to go down to the next level. In this case, it's an F2, and sentence within that range. And you can uniformly apply that to all 50 of these juveniles, and you get to a constitutional result without opening up all these other can of worms.
That's just throwing out the F1, though, isn't it? I mean, that's just canceling. Does that make sense?
Well, that's exactly what happened when we had this gap when our death penalty was unconstitutional after Ring, that for those few individuals who were unconstitutionally sentenced to death when the legislature didn't step in, that you had to go down to the next permissible sentence, which was life without parole for those very few.
Well, it was very clear in that statute, though, that was the alternative sentence. I mean, that was a pretty easy one. Now, that's not the case, right?
Well, one of the reasons why this is a reasonable solution for juveniles is that's very consistent with Miller. I mean, the Supreme Court said that the juveniles are constitutionally different, that they are per se less culpable than adults for all of these various reasons. And by making them per se having a lower sentencing scheme, by going down to the next lower offense on the statute, because that's all the court has left, that's very consistent with Miller. That still gives the sentencing court a wide range of options, because the sentencing court in this case can sentence him anywhere from 16 to 48 years. And 48 years for a 16-year-old is a very, very harsh sentence. That means he'll be spending 80% of his adult life in prison. The Attorney General made some kind of remarks like, well, you know, parole eligibility in your late 50s isn't so bad. We're all in our late 50s. Some of us are older. We have decades of useful life ahead of us, not when you're a prisoner. There's been no prisoner in the Colorado Department of Corrections who's served more than 54 years without passing away in prison. Prison life is very harsh. Just statistically speaking, if you have a sentence of life with parole eligibility up to 40 years, it's unusual for somebody to ever make it through that entire 40 years, which is the other problem with the Attorney General's solution. And that mandatory minimum imposed sentence of life without 40 is still going to be unconstitutional after Miller because of this language in Miller. And that is that any mandatorily imposed adult sentence to a juvenile offender pursuant to a scheme that poses too great a risk of disproportionate punishment violates the Eighth Amendment. And I respectfully submit that life with parole after 40 still poses too great a risk of disproportionate punishment for the very reason that if you make the juvenile offender spend 40 years of his adult life in prison, that is disproportionately greater than an adult offender in the same position. The adult offender isn't going to be spending 80% of his adult life in prison. The juvenile offender will.
Let me just interject. What would you do with the consecutive sentencing issue that we were discussing earlier? Ms. Warbaugh says that Miller doesn't address consecutive sentencing. That's an issue for another day. What's your, if you have multiple victims or you have a single victim but multiple crimes that would set up for possible consecutive sentencing, how do you think the court should approach that question with juvenile direct laws?
I disagree with the Attorney General that Miller does not address that issue. Miller most certainly does address that issue because it's mandatory consecutive sentence that you get in that situation of having to stack all of these mandatory minimum sentences where you get a result that's 50 years, 80 years, 100 years, 150 years, that still poses too great a risk of disproportionate punishment and is unconstitutional after Miller, and you cannot sentence a juvenile in those types of consecutive sentencing schemes without individualized sentencing, which we don't have yet in our Colorado statutory scheme because the legislature has not stepped in and amended the sentencing statute to be consistent with what Justice Kagan sets forth in Miller's, in the Miller case, of all these factors that the sentencing court must consider before handing out that type of harsh sentence that results in an effective life sentence without a meaningful opportunity for release. So in the case of these stacked sentences, where as a minimum, the juvenile offender is going to have to be given an individualized sentencing hearing where he's got the ability then to argue proportionality and get a lower sentence, which for adult offenders facing mandatory crime of violence sentencing and stacked sentences or consecutive sentences and mandatory minimums, the sentencing court, using a proportionality argument, still has the ability to go lower than the mandatory or the initial mandatory result under that crime of violence statute where you can come in 90 days after sentencing and reconsider. You can still have an individualized resentencing hearing that gets you to a constitutional result.
And which at the end of the road could still be effectively life without parole if it, in the appropriate case. Say you have a defendant who's 17 years, 364 days old, who commits a mass fatality. You have a mass fatality episode, and so that would still be a scenario in which a judge could sentence to could stack things in a way that would make that person effectively ineligible for parole at any point.
Yes.
Under your approach.
So long as the sentencing court gives an individualized sentencing hearing, considers all the factors that Justice Kagan set forth in Miller, and does the Eighth Amendment proportionality analysis, yes, you can get to that point in a very unusual circumstance, very unusual case, where you can have a constitutional, effective life without parole sentence for a juvenile in both these consecutive sentencing cases and the ordinary F1 case as well. But the reason why this court should not just remand for individualized resentencing hearings in all 50 of these cases is, well, that's not what the legislature stepped in and asked this court to do. There's still no statutory tether for that, and all those concerns that the court had, some of my colleagues, well, how does this look for the sentencing court? What exactly should the sentencing court be doing in these individualized sentencing hearings? There's no guidance here. Absolutely, I agree with that. That's why if this court wants to just stick with a statutory scheme, the only statutory scheme for this court then to utilize is sentencing to the next lower felony count level and ordering resentencing within that sentencing range. For in Mr. Jen.
Well, I would have to go back down to the court for sentencing, right? Within that range, I mean.
Well.
Just explain how that plays out to me.
Well, for Mr. Jensen,
yeah.
Then he would be remanded for resentencing in the F2 range. So he would still be given an individualized sentencing hearing because everybody who's convicted of an F2 gets an individualized sentencing hearing, whether they're an adult or a juvenile. So that piece of Miller is satisfied. Plus, he's going to have a meaningful opportunity for release because he's going to be parole eligible at some point between 16 and 48 years. But the sentencing court has a wide range of options available to it to give a constitutional sentence within that range that's appropriate for Mr. Jensen's maturity and the way he's matured out of that behavior. I mean, he's been locked up for 16 years. He's one of the longest incarcerated juvenile offenders that's been given life without parole.
Yeah, F2 is always a lesser of F1, is it?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Is F2 always a lesser of F1 in all of these cases?
No. With some felony murder cases, there was no F2 option.
Yeah.
But that doesn't apply for Mr. Jensen. He did have the F2 option that was instructed to the jury. With some of these other felony murder cases, though, there's some question as to whether under Graham, it's still constitutional to even sentence a juvenile offender who's convicted of felony murder to life without the possibility of parole. And that's another reason why the F3 option for the predicate felony conviction would be the appropriate sentencing range. If the court has no additional questions for me, I'd like to reserve my remaining 3 minutes.
You may do so, thank you.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Borbaugh for the people of the state of Colorado. I dispute a number of counsel's contentions. The first being that a sentence of life with possibility after 40 years is unconstitutional after Miller and Graham, because as I've stated, Miller doesn't find even a sentence to life without parole to be unconstitutional under all circumstances. What it finds is a mandatory sentence to life without parole to be unconstitutional. It has nothing to say that indicates that a sentence to life with the possibility of parole is unconstitutional. Similarly, as I said, Graham, being a non-homicide case, doesn't inform us on this point. I also dispute counsel's statement that there's no statutory support for my position, because my position, I believe, is supported by our existing statutes, including the statutes from 1985 to 1990 and the statutes again from 2006 to present. We see this as clearly how other juvenile offenders have been treated. Her solution, as Ms. Lord's was to impose a sentence for a class 2 felony, but as Justice Hoff said, that's essentially throwing out the class 1 felony, and I think that that's an unfair solution, and it shouldn't be utilized given that this court can craft a constitutional remedy within our existing statutes for a class 1 felony.
Can I ask you, can you respond to her argument that if we revive, excuse me, part of the statute, we got to revive all of it, or sever, we got to sever?
Your Honor, I don't agree with that. I think this court can read out those portions that as they relate to juveniles, but leave the statute standing with regard to adults. That's what the court did in the Banks case. That's what the courts have done, as I said, in the Florida cases, in the Massachusetts cases, in the Iowa cases. I think that while it has never been done in the state, it's a fair solution and can be done here. With regard to the question about when the death penalty was declared unconstitutional, clearly there was a separate severability statute covering the death penalty within our sentencing statutes. So that's why this court imposed life without parole, because it was a very specific statute in that case. With regard to the argument that juveniles are less culpable and should be treated differently from adults, it's clear that that's already done by removing death from the table, by saying that they are not subject to mandatory sentence of life without parole, but they are parole eligible after 40 years under the 2006 version of the statute. That, in fact, does treat juveniles differently from adults. I don't think that there's any factual support in the record regarding prison life expectancies that may be developed in other cases, but I don't think that's in any of these three cases before the court. The Court of Appeals cases have tended to either have evidentiary hearings or have relied on the Colorado statute regarding life expectancy. It certainly remains my position that Miller and Graham say nothing about consecutive sentencing. Miller talks about a mandatory sentence to life without parole and whether it can be imposed and under what circumstances. And Graham says that you can never impose a sentence to life without parole for a non-homicide offender. Neither of these cases speak to consecutive sentencing. I certainly would agree with counsel's statement that we need guidance. I think we can agree that this court needs to give the trial courts guidance on how to proceed in these 50 cases. Finally, I would say, just parenthetically, while she believes that Mr. Jensen is the longest serving individual who got life without parole, clearly there are other individuals such as, I cited the Valenzuela case, 825 P. 2nd, 1015. Mr. Valenzuela has been serving a life sentence under the old statutes. So he, in fact, is getting life with possibility of parole after 40 years, but he's still serving that sentence.
Counsel, you said the word finally, but I'm not going to let you be final. So, I mean, that is a great segue. Your brief basically says, for policy reasons, you're conceding retroactive application. Can I just delve a little bit into that? I mean, what policy reasons are you referring to?
The policy reasons mostly have to do with the legislature's subsequent action in 2006. That I think that if our statute remained life without parole, that an important policy choice would be to try to hold on to these sentences for all such individuals. But because our legislature changed course in 2006 and decided to give juveniles a sentence of life and the possibility of parole after 40 years, it seems, again, a fair and just solution to treat all of these individuals equally. I certainly understand there's a split between the circuits and their support for saying that Miller should not be retroactive. The people just have not chosen to take that position.
Well, and I appreciate that. But I'm wondering, I mean, how is this case different than any other post-conviction case? I mean, are you arguing that there are special conditions or circumstances here that we should treat this differently?
Well, how this case is different, again, is that it's bookended by the 1985-90 statutes giving life without parole, and in the 2006 to present statutes giving life without parole. So because it's bookended in this way, it seems appropriate to treat Banks and Tate in the same way as Jensen, or perhaps I should say Jensen in the same way as Banks and Tate, that rather than treat them differently, it seems like a fair and just solution to treat not only all these 50 defendants from 1990 to 2006 in the same way, but also bring them under the larger time frame of 1985 to the present.
So I guess your representation that there are 50 cases out there, it's not actually 50 cases. It's more than that because you should be including, or that's it.
Your Honor, there are 50 cases, is my understanding. I suppose I would say 50 odd. It's somewhere over 50, it's somewhere less than 60, between 1990 and 2006. Obviously, there are individuals since 2006 who've been sentenced to life without possibility of parole. That's not an issue here. There are also the folks, such as Mr. Valenzuela, who were sentenced under the 1985 to 1990 statute, who are serving sentences of life without parole until the possibility after 40 years. So, but when we have those...
Just tell me, what is the 50 cases are what? They're
between 1990 and 2006.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, those are the 50 cases. I think just a few of them are on direct appeal. There's definitely Banks and Tate, and then there's another case that's been decided by the Court of Appeals called Bias. And Mr. Bias may be the last one. I mean, I suppose cold cases could arise at some point.
Okay. But the vast majority are not on direct review.
No, that's correct. The vast majority, I believe, because of all the intervening time, I believe the vast majority convictions and sentences have been affirmed on appeal, and so their convictions are final.
Okay, thank you.
Post-conviction review allows the courts at any time to review an illegal sentence, right? Are all of these illegal sentences that you just referred to?
The sentences I'm referring to are the ones between 1990 and 2006.
Okay, you would say those are illegal sentences.
Right. So
they can be reached under the post-conviction review.
Or at least there's certainly unconstitutional sentences, to the extent that we define illegal sentences as those not authorized by statute. They may or may not be authorized by statute, but they're definitely unconstitutional after Miller.
Okay.
So, yeah, that is a category of cases before this court.
Okay.
And I would again urge this court that a fair and just solution is to treat all of these folks over the course of three decades the same. The court can get there by either a severability or by a revival analysis. And I would commend this court's attention those cases, as I said, from Iowa and Massachusetts, that use severability and do create a juvenile exception in that way, or the very interesting cases out of Florida implement statutory revival. Thanks for your time and attention.
Thank you.
First of all, what the Attorney General is arguing this for is mandatorily impose life with parole after 40. Yes, after Miller, life with parole after 40 would be a constitutional sentence after an individualized sentence hearing, but that's not what the Attorney General is asking this court to do. She's asking this court to mandatorily impose that sentence on all 50 of these offenders without individualized sentencing. That is not constitutional after Miller. That still poses this disproportionate risk of harshness that violates the Eighth Amendment. And if this court wanted that solution, it would first have to give individualized sentencing hearings for all of those 50 offenders. There's no simple solution other than what I'm suggesting, which is to go to the next felony count down, whether that's an F2 or an F3. There is no just mandatorily imposed life sentence that this court could order for all of these juvenile offenders that would pass the constitutional test under Miller without running the risk of opening itself to arguments. This is still running the risk of disproportionate sentences with no meaningful opportunity for release. And the only way to ensure that sentence would be constitutional is to have the individualized sentencing hearing. Now, resentencing based on a lesser included offense is in line with the Supreme Court's decision in Roper versus Simmons, Rare versus Florida, and now Miller versus Alabama. The juveniles are categorically less culpable than adults who commit similar offenses. That's not an unfair result. That's a result that's consistent with what the U.S. Supreme Court is telling us we have to do. And as far as Mr. Jensen in particular and mortality tables, yes, there's a lot that could be developed factually regarding life expectancies, but we do have a statute, CRS 1325-103, that does provide a mortality table. And just this past legislative session, the Senate Bill 1448 moved to amend that statute because gross disproportionate mortality expectancies between especially black males and white males, as pointed out by U.S. Census results. So there is statutory guidance for the court to look at when you don't have to just accept the Attorney General's argument that, well, anybody with life, with any juvenile who's given a sentence of life with parole after 40, that's by definition a meaningful opportunity for release. That's not true. That's inconsistent with the mortality tables. It's also inconsistent with the United States Supreme Court's ruling in Miller. So for all these reasons, I'm asking for remand for sentencing in the F2 range. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your argument. I appreciate the argument of all the counsel who have taken part in this argument this morning. The court appreciates your briefing and your oral argument this morning.